Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
First of all, I want to thank you all for coming this evening and coming out to support your local and independent bookseller. We really do appreciate it, and it really does make a difference. My name is Derek. Just in case you have any questions, I've been with the store, gosh, it's, I think I'm into my third decade now. Second, at least two, which I've enjoyed. No, thank you, thank you. So, but if you have any questions, please find me. I'll be somewhere around here in the event space. And let's get on to the getting on. Tonight, I just want to just do a brief introduction for tonight's author. As a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and a person who spent his fair share of time screenwriting on the mean streets of Hollywood, tonight's author knows his way around a great story. The new novel tonight is just a wonderful book. And in it, he combines a couple different things. Well, first of all, that knack of storytelling. The secondly, he also combines that deep knowledge of the inner workings of law enforcement as well as military affairs that he developed as an investigative reporter. And then lastly, just a love of flying, which he still indulges as a private pilot. All of that combines into the great hero, Cordell Logan, who is... I look forward to seeing other editions and hearing more about his adventures as the years go on. So please join me in welcoming tonight's author, David Fareed.
Well, thank you all very much for coming out. I really much appreciate it. Derek, thank you very much for that great introduction. You know, this is one of these, when you're a writer and you go to these events, you really have no idea what you're going to get. So in that regard, you kind of feel a little bit like Forrest Gump. Actually, you kind of feel like Forrest Gump in many ways. I had a nonfiction book that was published about 15 years ago that was called Dear Ernest and Julio, and it was ostensibly a – it was a humor book, and I say ostensibly because some people thought it was funny and others didn't, but it was a book of rejection – it was a book of job application letters that I sent out under a nom de plume for jobs that I was not qualified for, and the actual responses that I got back from them. And so in that regard – I had occasion to go out on a tour not dissimilar to the one I'm on now, which is a very truncated tour. But I live in California, and at the time I was living in Los Angeles, and so I had been invited to speak at a journalism conference out east of Los Angeles at Claremont McKenna College, and the publicist, I'd mentioned this to the publicist, my plan was I was going to go speak at this journalism seminar, then I was going to head up to Las Vegas and go visit my sister. So the publicist said, oh, well, if you're going to be in that area, we'll set you up with a reading. And so I said, great. So as it turns out, the reading was in Temecula. Now, I don't know if anybody knows where Temecula is, but it's about 85, 90 miles, east of Los Angeles, and it's, you know... It may not be in the middle of nowhere, but you can see it from there. And it was on a Saturday. And so at the appointed hour, I went in to the bookstore, which, as I recall, I think was a B. Dalton. I might be wrong about that, but it gives you some idea of how long it's been. And I went up and introduced myself to the guy that was working the cash register, who just happened to be the manager. And he said, oh, it's great to see you. We got you set up over here, and we're going to start in a few minutes. And about 5 minutes before I was supposed to go on, he got on the loudspeaker, and he was like, welcome to B. Dalton's, and we're going to be starting in just a few minutes with our featured speaker, author David Fareed. He'll be over here at the... And he kind of went on and on, and I noticed that there was nobody in the store. Not a soul, except for the guy that was working the cash register. So, a couple of minutes before I was supposed to go on, same deal. Well, please welcome David Fareed over here. And so they set me up at an arrangement not dissimilar to this, and I just kind of stood there. And he came up to me after about, and there was literally no one in the store. And so after a few minutes, he came up to me and he apologized and he said, you know, I think that, I think there was like a girls basketball tournament in town that weekend or something. And so anyway, so he said, well, why don't you just have a seat over here? So I sat down at the table, again, similar to this, and I just sat there. Minding, you know, and I figured I'll just hang out for about an hour. And at one point, a guy came into the store. And he was a big bellied biker looking guy. I remember he had a white t-shirt and a black leather vest and a black kind of floppy hat. And it was sort of like fishing, you know, where you see the fish in the lake and you're trying to catch the fish. I was sitting there kind of... And eventually the guy did sort of mosey over to where I was sitting, and this is how I'm not embellishing it, this is exactly how it went down. He came over, I'm sitting there, he grabs a copy of my book off the stack, and he starts going like this. Then he goes, "Did you write this?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And he went, "Uh-huh." And he put it down and just walked away. So again, thank you for coming, because it's always a very difficult proposition, because I mean, I'd much rather make a fool of myself in front of a bunch of people than make a fool of myself just sitting there. I thought it would be worthwhile to talk about what it's like to the sort of the tragicomic experiences of writing a novel and getting it published, which is these days an increasing rarity. I saw a statistic that something on the order of 1 out of 1,000 novels gets published these days. So for that, I feel very fortunate. And I'll explain that in a little bit, how it all came to pass. But I, in the course of my research, after I had gotten my initial round of rejections, I wanted to see who else had been rejected. And it turns out many, many people have been rejected in very profound and innumerable ways. And so if you'll indulge me, I just wanted to read some of these because I thought they were really funny. These are authors whose first novels were flat out rejected, and the language in the rejection letters that they received. This was for William Faulkner's The Reavers. Faulkner got a letter that said, "If the book had a plot and structure, we might suggest shortening it and revisions, but it is so diffuse that I don't think this would be of any use. My chief objection is that you don't have anything to say." Stephen King's Carrie, he got a rejection letter that said, "We are not interested in science fiction which deals with negative utopias. They do not sell." Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. I really haven't the foggiest idea about what the man is trying to say. Apparently the author intends it to be funny, possibly even satire, but it is really not funny in any intellectual level. And Dr. Seuss, his book is too different from other juvenile books on the market to warrant its selling. And my personal favorite, which was F. Scott Fitzgerald, "You'd have a book if you got rid of that Gatsby character." So, as Derek said, this is sort of a homecoming for me. I have many friends in the audience here and who I've known for 30 plus years. And I grew up in Denver. I went to school at Colorado State University, where I started out as a pre-med major, pre-med bioscience major. And I knew after about a year of beer and girls that with a GPA of about 2.2 that I was not going to get into Harvard Med School. And so I realized that I had to figure out a way to make a living. And I remembered that a high school teacher had encouraged me to think about writing. And for whatever reason, when I was going through the course catalog, I thought about, you know, I stumbled upon journalism, and I thought, oh, journalism, I can do that. So, and I can apply these credits that I've gotten already to the major. So I graduated with a degree in journalism, and I went to work at a newspaper in Colorado Springs called The Sun, which doesn't exist anymore. And I was assigned to cover the military beat and the police beat. The military, I think, principally because this was right after Vietnam and nobody wanted to cover the military. But I had SCADs are fun doing it because I got to fly around with the military and shoot guns and drive around in tanks and rappelled and helicopters and stuff. And it was just, I just had a wonderful time. So I spent a few years in Colorado Springs, and I moved on to the Rocky Mountain News, where I was, where I worked for about 3 years. And then I moved on to the Los Angeles Times. I should say parenthetically too, that I got a pilot's license when I was living in Colorado Springs. So I went to work at the Los Angeles Times initially in San Diego, where by virtue of my experience covering the military in Colorado Springs, I wound up covering the military in San Diego. So I covered every branch of the service, the Army, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Navy. And then I got promoted, which I always thought was kind of a misnomer, to the main operation in downtown Los Angeles, where I spent like an eternity. But I got to do a lot of wonderful, neat things there, too, including covering Operation Desert Storm, again, by virtue of the fact that I knew I could distinguish rank among military members, whereas most people on the staff could not. So after I left the Times, I worked briefly as an associate field producer and, in essence, a glorified investigator for CBS News covering the O.J. Simpson case. And from there... And in the interim, I was screenwriting because I really decided that I didn't want to live in Los Angeles. I didn't want to raise my kids in L.A. And so I started to kind of noodle around with screenwriting. And to make a very long story short, I wrote a screenplay that I thought was incredibly redemptive about an old man who enters a cross-country bicycle race. It's based on a true story. And I had an agent at that point, and I gave it to the agent, and the agent gave it to the studios, and the studios all said, it's too small and too soft to be a studio picture. So I said, oh, okay, I know what they want. I was really mad about this, by the way. They want a big, stupid, you know, completely improbable action movie. So I'm going to write the stupidest action movie I can think of. And I literally spent about 20 seconds thinking up the plot. And I wrote it demonically, laughing at the improbabilities of it. Turned it into my agent after about 3 weeks or something, and it went to the studios and on a Thursday, as I remember, and on Tuesday I had two studios bidding on it, so it allowed me to segue away from journalism and from living in Los Angeles, and I moved to Santa Barbara. But as I continued down the path of screenwriting, I came to realize that you can get paid a lot of money to do it, but at the end of the day, it's, you know, in many instances, it's very kind of a hollow pursuit. You know, you can get paid to write things that never get made, which was invariably the case with me. I mean, I can't tell you the number of screenplays I was commissioned to write that never saw the light of day, and probably for good reason, because they really sucked. But So coupled with, let me back up just a little bit. So when I lived in San Diego and I worked for the Times, I made the acquaintance of a neighbor who was a Navy SEAL. And we became very good friends. And by virtue of my friendship with that gentleman, I became friends with other SEALs. And so over the span of time, not when I was working as a journalist, but after I left the ranks of journalism, I started working in the intelligence community. It wasn't James Bond stuff necessarily, but it was pretty cool, and I got to see things and do things that I wouldn't have done ordinarily as a journalist. So all of which is to say that when I decided to sit down and write a novel, they always say, well, write what you know. And I came to the very quick realization that what I don't know could fill, you know, millions of bookstores. But I do know a little bit about a lot. And so I thought, well, let's see, I know about aviation because I'm a pilot and I have an airplane. I've covered the police, and I've been to any number of crime scenes. I covered the military, so I know a little bit about that. And I've also worked in the intelligence community. So what could I possibly gin up that would be, you know, viable and be interesting? And so I came up with a character whose name is Cordell Logan, who is a former Air Force fighter pilot who winds up going to work in the intelligence community in an organization that, for lack of a better description, is an assassination squad, and which is ultimately disbanded when the new administration comes into power in the White House, and he suddenly finds himself out of a job. So he goes back to Rancho Bonita, which looks suspiciously like Santa Barbara, where I live, and becomes a civilian flight instructor. And he struggles to make a living until one day when his ex-wife approaches him and asks him whether he will get involved in investigating the murder of the man she left him for, who is also a former member of this this covert operation that, that they used to work for. So I had a lot of fun putting this thing together. People have asked me how long did it take me, and I honestly don't know, because I would write it in increments, and then I would have to set it aside and do magazine assignments, and in a couple of cases write some screenplays. But I would say probably after about 3 years. And so I finished it, and then I had an idea for a nonfiction idea, which I won't bore you with. But I submitted the nonfiction idea to a literary agent named Jill Marr, Sandra Dykstra and Jill Marr. And they liked the idea. They tried to settle it. They tried to sell it, rather, without success. And then they said, well, what else you got? And I said, well, you know, I got this novel, and it's kind of quirky, and but you might like it. And so I gave it to them, and to my surprise and my, you know, great delight, they liked it. So I immediately thought that I was going to get a table reserved at Elaine's in New York, you know, that that was the next step in the process. And it was not to be. The book went out to probably about a dozen publishers, and all of them passed. I didn't get the kind of nasty, snarky responses that F. Scott Fitzgerald did. And I'm not comparing myself to him for a minute, but I did get some nice notes, and you know, people had this and that to say. And there was one publisher though in New York that did, an editor there did like it, and so she asked me via my agent whether I would be willing to consider. She liked the way it was written. She loved the characters. She hated the plot. And would I be willing to rewrite the plot? And and not without any sort of pay, of course, but the intimation was that if I did this, there might be a couple of book deal, you know, involved. So without any other birds in the hand, I thought, all right, well, I'll go ahead and do that. And so that took me several months. And then I turned the manuscript back in, and the agent liked it, the editor in New York liked it, and I was fully waiting every day for my phone to ring, say, here's a, you know, we're going to publish your novel and another novel, and you know, and you're going to get your table at Elaine's. And and then weeks turned into months, and months turned into more months, and finally one day I got a very terse email from my agent that just said simply, this editor's boss couldn't get behind the book, and they were passing. And so I was like pretty debilitated, pretty deflated. And, but you know, she's a great agent. She said, don't worry, you know, we're going to sell this thing. And so it went out through a second round of submissions. And by virtue, I think, of the changes that I made to the manuscript per this one editor's notes, which were good, she sent it out to like six publishers, and three of them expressed keen interest. Two of them said, well, we're going to have to run it up the chain of command. You know, we have to go to the committee, and you never know. That could, I can't promise you anything by the end of the day. But the third publisher, who's kind of an old school operation, the head guy there liked what he read the first few pages, and he said, send me the book. You know, can you FedEx me the manuscript overnight, because I don't like reading books on the computer. So she did, and then my good fortune was that there was a huge blizzard in New York. And this is, you know, there's a lot of serendipity in all of this. And so the blizzard, basically, he was snowed in, and he had nothing to do. And the FedEx guy couldn't get in, you know. So this was a year ago in January. And so he started reading the book online. And as self-serving as it sounds, you know, he said he couldn't stop reading it. And so the next week they made an offer on the book. And so I was very, very pleased about that, needless to say. And so flash forward, the book, it comes out in an advanced review copy form. And, you know, which is a galley copy. And I'm totally excited about this, you know. And so I give the copies that they've sent me to various and sundry relatives. Including my mother, who, if you'd have to know my mother, but she's never one to be very generous in her praise. She's never wanted her children to have big heads, I guess. I think that's her rationale. But anyway, so we were down visiting with her. She lives in Florida now, and we were down visiting with her a few months ago before the book came out last month, and she said, hours went by before she mentioned the book, and then she said, well, I started reading your book, and I have to say, I was very surprised by how much hardcore pornography there is in it. And I thought, my first thought was, first of all, I don't know what book you're reading because there is no pornography. And then my second thought was, if you wrote a book that had pornography in it, would you send it to your mother? You know? So anyway, no, she was adamant that there was. I said, Mom, what book are you reading? Because that's not the book. And so she's, oh yeah, there's pornography in there. And so upon further exploration, my mother is like the queen of malapropisms. And as it turns out, she meant profanity. And even, you know, even that was, you know, okay, yeah, there's a few F-bombs in there, but it's not like profanity laced. So that was rather awkward. So, okay, so then the book comes out. What I discovered, it's really interesting. Everybody wants to know whether they're in your book. You know, all your friends. Where am I in the book? Who am I? You know, what character did you base on, you know, me? And I'm like, the reality is that there is no character in. I've taken a few liberties with people's names. There are people in the audience here that whose names I actually used in, but they bear no resemblance to the actual person. But so the only character in the book that is based on any true being is my hero has a cat named Kidiot, who's the world's stupidest cat, and we actually did have a cat named Kidiot who was the world's stupidest cat. You met that cat, Robert? All right, okay, you guys did too. This cat was so stupid that we moved into our house, it has a cat door. And the cat, you know, it took the cat 5 years to figure out that we had a cat door. She would stand there by the back door and yowl to be let out 15 times a day, and then yowl to be let back in. And then finally, and I would show her the cat door, you know, one of those rubberized cat door things. And finally, I just got so angry with her one day, I just picked her up and slammed her through the cat door. I didn't hurt her or anything, but, you know, she went flying outside and stood there like she was on an episode of The Twilight Zone. Like, I've never seen anything like this. So there are no characters in the book that are based on real people. But that hasn't stopped people from asking those questions. And so a friend of mine who I actually ran the book by after I'd finished the first draft, who's a retired Los Angeles police captain, I had made the mistake of telling him that he was in the book. And he sent me an email that said, am I the pilot, the dead guy, or the ex-wife? And I said in as many words, well, you know, you're a performer, professional crime fighter. I mean, you figure it out. So as it turns out, he's mentioned by name in the acknowledgments, along with many other people to whom I'm indebted. And his response after finding his name in the book was, and this is his exact quote, shit, you killed me off on the second page. Anyway, the other interesting response I got was, I would have to say, was from my 23-year-old daughter, who is normally a very voracious reader. But in this case, she had the book, a copy of the book, and weeks went by, months went by, you know, didn't hear a response. And I didn't really know how to broach the subject with her, like, are you going to read my book? And finally, my wife asked her, I asked my wife, what's the deal with Rachel? And my wife, so she asked our daughter, well, why haven't you read this dad's book? And as it turns out, she was completely traumatized. This is sort of like, you know, the unforeseen consequences of writing fiction. She was completely traumatized and thought somehow, she couldn't figure out how much of my character was me. And how much of the character was somebody who I wanted to be? Is this really daddy? You know? And so I, you know, and I, so all I had a conversation with her, and I said, well, let's see. my hero is divorced and pining over his ex-wife and has been for years. He lives in a converted garage with a stupid cat who pays him no attention whatsoever. I really don't think that this is the guy that I would want to be. But I'm still not sure that she thinks. I still think she thinks that I am, in some fashion or another, the guy that I wrote. But I can assure you that I'm not. So in any case, what I'd like to do is, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to read 40 or 50 pages from the book. I'm told the store closes at 9, but we can go over. And then we'll wrap this up. Actually, not 40 or 50 pages, maybe just like 3 pages. And I forgot to bring my book, so I have to use one of these. I saw this. I was watching TV the other night, and have you seen the movie Capote? Yeah, Capote comes out when he's going to read Cold Blood, and he just comes out and goes, "I'm Truman Capote, thank you." And then he starts reading the book, you know, and I thought, well, that's pretty cool. Maybe I should try that, but... But, you know, my book's not as good as In Cold Blood. Okay, so. Excuse me. Okay, so about 3 pages. I can't say whether there was a second gunman in Dallas the day JFK was assassinated, though anyone familiar with the elegant efficiency of your basic L-shaped ambush could take one look at the 6th-floor sniper's nest and the stockade fence behind the grassy knoll on Dealey Plaza and draw their own conclusions. I can't say whether it was a flying saucer outside Roswell in 1957, or whether Elvis is alive and well and eating chili dogs with Marilyn Monroe on some obscure island in the Mediterranean. What I can say with certainty is that until very recently, in the name of national security, the government of the United States relied on a select handful of men to do its dirty work in places and in ways that never once made the network news. The agency to which these men reported was classified Tier 1 Ultra and codenamed Alpha, a purposeful tip of the hat to Alpha, Russia's most elite counterterrorism unit. Known only within highly compartmentalized circles, Alpha showed up on no Defense Department orders of battle. There was never a mention of it in any congressional budget reports, nor on any blogs. No tweets. Culled from the various branches of America's military and intelligence apparatus for their individual skills, elite operators assigned to Alpha surrendered all formal rank and title. They were referred to synonymously as go-to guys. They were hunter-killers, these men, honed in the art of asymmetric warfare and oblivious to the sovereignty of treaties or international borders. They proved an invaluable weapon in the fight against global terrorism, but they were not invulnerable to the vagaries of shifting political winds. The current administration, fearing scandal if word of Alpha's actions were ever fully known, quietly ordered the group disbanded within a month of Inauguration Day. White House officials, past and present, will deny there was ever any go-to guys. There were ever any go-to guys. But I know there were, because I was one of them, and so too was Arlo Echevarria. I'd be on the next Conair flight to Supermax were I to divulge all that we did. That's how non-disclosure agreements work. Sign one, tell a few tales out of school, and the next thing you know, you're bunking with Robert Hansen and stamping out license plates the rest of your life. So you'll excuse me if I'm a bit vague on operational details, target IDs, mission locations, and the like. What I can tell you, though, is how Echevarria and I worked together, how I initially revered him, and how ultimately I wished him dead. For me, it began in college. We were playing New Mexico in Albuquerque my senior year. With time about to expire before halftime, I snagged a pass cutting across the middle and turned to run upfield when the Lobos' 240-pound middle linebacker, a first-round NFL prospect with "I shall fear no man but God" tattooed across his throat, separated me from my cleats. The football went one way, the major structural ligaments of my right knee the other. And so ended my collegiate gridiron career. Fortunately for me, playing football was not the only reason the Air Force put me through college. Flash forward 10 years. I'm flying A-10 Warthogs. The Hog sometimes gets a bad rap from other fighter pilots who drive ships with pointier noses, but there's no better platform when it comes to blowing up stuff. I blew up stuff real good all over the world and got paid well to do it. Tanks, Republican guardsmen, miscellaneous terrorists. A total blast, literally. Then, during an otherwise routine 6-month physical, my friendly flight surgeon asked if I had any squawks. I made the mistake of telling him, half-jokingly, that I was considering applying for work at the Weather Channel because I could always tell when a low-pressure system was moving in based on how lousy my surgically reconstructed knee felt. The doctor bent and prodded my lower leg this way and that, then concluded that the joint had atrophied beyond acceptable Air Force standards. I was ruled unfit to fly. At that moment, no longer a fighter pilot, I could have just as easily been ruled unfit to continue living. I spent a month searching for the true meaning of life at the bottom of bourbon bottles, debating whether to resign my commission. The airlines were hiring like crazy back then. Most were so desperate for pilots, they didn't care about something as trivial as a reconstructed anterior cruciate ligament. As long as you had a pulse and could more or less keep the dirty side of the airplane down, you were assured of a paycheck. For me, though, the notion of hauling software salesmen and colicky infants around in the back of a 737 held all the appeal of driving a Greyhound bus. I enjoyed being in the Air Force. I just needed a different career path. My superiors, as it turned out, were only too happy to accommodate me. Soldiers and Marines are quick to point out that the Air Force is the most non-military of the military services. They call it the Air Farce, the Chair Farce, civilians in uniform, a country club with airplanes. Deservedly so. Most Air Force weenies can't tell the difference between a handgun and a howitzer. I was somewhat unusual in that regard. When you bounce from ranch to ranch as a foster kid on the arid plains east of Denver, you quickly learn that, one, much of Colorado bears little resemblance to a Coors commercial, and two, shooting firearms is about all there is to do recreationally in such places unless you count goat roping and getting loaded and or laid. Goats give me the creeps, booze I discovered early on brings out the bad in me, and street narcotics always seem to me a stupid thing to do to one's physiology. But guns, ah. Now those were another story altogether. I loved the precision they demanded, their perfect utility. For my 12th birthday, my foster parents de jure gave me an old single-shot bolt-action 22 with a red cocking indicator and a battered walnut stock. It was the most animate, inanimate object I'd ever seen, let alone owned. I worked every job I could, digging irrigation ditches, shoveling snow, pulling weeds, to buy ammunition and target practiced endlessly. Cans, bottles, rocks, birds on the wing, varmints on the run. After a while, I could hit anything with consistency and at ranges that sounded more like bragging than marksmanship, which helped explain why, after being admitted to the Air Force Academy, I consistently registered among the highest scores in school history with both pistol and M16. My performance on the firing range was not lost on my superiors when they sought to find me a suitable new job after clipping my wings. Such ability, they concluded, lent itself to the wonderful world of military informational gathering and assessment. What one's shooting skills has to do with flying a desk as an intelligence analyst was beyond me, but I didn't ask many questions. Most things in the military make no sense. And thus, with some initial reluctance, I accepted a series of ground-based assignments, first to the Air Intelligence Agency at Wright-Patterson, then to the National Air Intelligence Center at Lackland Air Force Base, until finally I ended up where I did, in the darkest shadows, on the blackest operations, a token Zumi in the land of snake eaters, among them a warrior of Mayan ancestry who would one day steal from me the only woman I ever truly loved. Thank you. And I would be honored to answer any questions anyone might have. Nope. Yes.
Can you tell us about the next one?
I can tell you that I should be working on it. It's a two book deal, and I had thought that I had a year to write the second one, and Then the publisher called me up about maybe 4 months ago and said, "Hey, how's that second book coming?" And I was like, "Well, I was sort of marshaling my thoughts and kind of outlining, you know." And I said, "Well, when do you need it by?" Excuse me. And he said, "Well, if you want to get it out by 2013, the 2013 catalog, you really have to get it in by the end of July." And I was like, "So I'm making very good progress on it, and I'm probably about 7/8 of the way done. It's sort of a juggling act because I have to try to get that in, and then this is not, you know, this, it sounds like this is torture. It's not, but it, you know, I have to do these as well as try to write. So, Well, you know, that's subject to debate, actually. The original title of the book was called The Alpha Conspiracy because I thought, well, the guy's associated with this group called Alpha. And everybody was like, Alpha Conspiracy? What does that mean? And so I realized that it had to be kind of an aviation-related sort of something aviation related. And a flat spin is like if you saw like The Right Stuff, where Chuck Yeager punches out of an F-104 that's in a flat spin, or when Top Gun, when Goose gets killed. Those are flat spins. But really, the title is really sort of a metaphor for the state of Logan's life when we first meet him. You know, the debate still rages. There are still people that are like, flat spin. My mother, among them, like, what does that mean? You know, and I try to explain it to her, and I'm not sure she still understands. I assured her it wasn't pornographic. I promised her it wasn't pornographic. Really? Okay, well, then I guess we're done. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm intrigued with Buddhism. I'm not a Buddhist, but the more I read about it, the more I think it makes a whole lot of sense. And I thought it would be an interesting juxtaposition to have a protagonist who has spent many years essentially killing a lot of people, trying to come to terms with that on a moral basis, and not necessarily one that is overtly religious, but. You know, I think it's really, I learned as a screenwriter that it's really important when you create a character to try to infuse that character with characteristics, you know, so that they do not appear necessarily cardboardish or wooden. I may be wrong, but I can't remember any protagonists in books, certainly in this genre, excuse me, that are Buddhists. I'd be more than happy to stand corrected, but I just don't know of any. So.
Were you ever influenced by Robert Parker?
I was very influenced by Robert Parker. Yeah, I went through kind of a Robert Parker bent, where I just thought, Spencer's a cool guy, you know, and the thing that I took away from Robert B. Parker and tried to infuse in Logan was that sort of like, you know, a guy that can say things that the rest of us wishes we could say, but get away with it. You know, I mean, Spencer is always like going around basically telling people off in very sort of blunt spoken ways. And if anybody tries to call him out on it, he knocks their teeth out. And I thought, gee, I wish I could do that, you know? And so, you know, in that regard, Logan is very much the same way. But the one thing too is that's sort of where the paths divert, because it's like, it seemed to me that after a while, and when you read Robert B. Parker, a lot of his books were all about Spencer going to really expensive restaurants in Boston, which I'm sure, you know, Robert B. Parker deducted, you know. So I guess I need to figure, I need to figure that. You know, the other thing, interesting parenthetically, is my father-in-law is also a pilot. And when I told him that, and who hates the IRS with a passion. And when I told him that I had sold this novel and that the hero was, you know, a pilot, my father-in-law said, well, then you can deduct all your flying expenses. And so started thinking about it, and I said, well, what percentage of my expenses do you think I should write off? He goes, 90%. And I was like, no, you know, I'll get audited for sure. So if anybody's out there, you know, has ties to the IRS, it's 49%.
I was very pleased to see that when you wrote this book and it was finished, that the characters, you didn't bother to tie up all the loose ends.
I didn't. I thought I did.
And there's nothing left, nothing to the imagination. And when you finish this book, you kind of wonder, well, okay, now he took this trip in his airplane, and what's going to happen to him next? What's he going to do? Is he and Savannah going to get back together? Is this going to happen? Is that going to happen? Well, I mean, you've got enough stories for another 10 books about this.
From your lips to God's ears. I mean, you know, are you kidding?
I want to know what's going to happen, and I can't wait to read the next.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
That, to me, is the mark of a good writer.
Thank you.
He doesn't try to tie everything.
Well, that was just gross incompetence on my part, because I really, that was my ambition. I got to tie all this stuff up. And so somewhere, I'm sure there are threads out there that I just kind of lost track of, you know.
Well, in my opinion, it was a good thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Did you have a question, Robert?
Yeah.
No, but he kind of, it was an extrapolation, you know, one thing led to another. And did you, you thought it was kind of one of those Dallas moments where it was all kind of a dream? No. That's, you know, those kind of things happen all the... Well, I mean, but it was sort of based on events that had occurred, you know, preceding that. But no, I mean, that happens. I mean, pilots get popped all the time for violating TFRs, temporary, you know, flight restricted areas. And fortunately, that hasn't occurred to me. But they actually, you literally have to be briefed on, like, hand signals from the F-16 pilot pulls up on your wing, you know. So I don't know of anybody that's ever happened to. But, you know, every few months, some dummy, you know, flies too close to the White House or doesn't get a briefing before he takes off and finds out after the fact that the vice president is, you know, visiting wherever. So... actually, that's an interesting question, Anne. Because I have a friend of mine who is an editor who was editing a book at the time about the rampant sort of Wild West atmosphere that is Kazakhstan these days, as far as efforts by companies to exploit the oil resources there. And so we were having lunch one day before I started writing this book, and he was telling me about this book that he was editing and about what was going on in Kazakhstan. And I thought, that's kind of cool. You know, I mean, you know, it's a part of the world that very few people have had any exposure to, which meant that I could take a lot of liberties and nobody except like a Russian scholar would like know that I'd messed up. No one's asked me that question before. It's a good question. You know, the first book that I told you about, the one where I was out in Temecula, where I got such a big turnout, I did have an agent at that point. And then, she kind of branched off and started doing books that had no bearing on what I was writing. So, when I realized, when I had this idea for the nonfiction book, you know, it was actually pretty easy, to be very honest with you. I had a friend who was represented by the Dykstra Agency, which is regarded as, you know, probably the most powerful literary agency on the West Coast. And I said to my friend, you know, could you make introductions for me? And he did. And Sandy Dykstra liked the idea that I'd given her, the nonfiction idea, and then tried to sell it. Didn't have any success doing that. And then it was a function of, I said, well, what else you got? And I said, well, I got this novel. It's a mystery thriller. And she said, oh, I'm going to turn you over to one of our other agents who handles that in our office. And so it was, you know, actually a very, in terms of the difficulties of the process, that was probably the least difficult of them all. You know, agents are always looking for material and new authors to represent. But, you know, you have to have something that interests them because, you know, there are a lot of people out there, obviously, that can't get representation. So I consider myself very fortunate in that regard. So thank you very much. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.